Today in Vanity Fair, reporter Gabe Sherman published a feature story detailing the terrifyingly competent Trump 2024 campaign. And there is a lot in the piece that is alarming. But what jumped out as potentially the most alarming detail was that within the actual Trump campaign, the person whose name is being floated to be Trump's Attorney General of the United States to run the Justice Department is this guy.
We will go out and find the conspirators, not just in government, but in the media. Yes, we're going to come after the people in the media who lied about American citizens, who helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. We're going to come after you, whether it's criminally or civilly. We'll figure that out. But yeah, we're putting you all on notice.
That is Kash Patel, the former chief of staff to Trump's Secretary of Defense, a man who is apparently on the short list for attorney general if Donald Trump retakes office. Now, Trump has not been shy about his desire to weaponize the DOJ and use it to go after his enemies, and we should probably take him at his word about that. I do think he is serious, but don't just take it from me. Last month, Trump announced that all of the January 6th committee members should go to jail. And today, the LA Times interviewed some of those members to ask how seriously they were taking those threats. Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren said, "One thing I learned on the committee is to pay attention and listen to what Trump says because he means it. If he intends to eliminate our constitutional system and start arresting his political enemies, I guess I would be on that list." The paper also interviewed Congressman Adam Schiff, who Trump has made one of his top political enemies. Schiff told The Times that he is having real-time conversations with his staff about how to make sure he stays safe if Trump follows through on his threats. So the danger here is apparently very real. And the Biden administration is doing something about it. Right before Trump's potential future Attorney General Kash Patel told Steve Bannon that he would use the government to go after Trump's enemies, Patel laid out what he thinks would need to happen within the government to empower him. He'd have to clean house.
Do you believe that you can deliver the goods on this in a pretty short order the first couple of months so we can get rolling on prosecutions?
Yes, we got the bench for it, Bannon, and you know those guys. I'm not going to go out there and say their names right now so the radical left-wing media can terrorize them. But, excuse me, the one thing we learned in the Trump administration the first go-around is we got to put in all America patriots top to bottom.
Well, today, the Biden administration issued a new rule, an attempt to Trump-proof the White House. The rule strengthens job protections for federal workers so Trump can't just clean house and replace everyone in the executive branch with MAGA hat-wearing Trump supporters. So, yes, Trump could still try to go after his enemies, and he could still try to install someone like Kash Patel as the attorney general to do so. But that attorney general would have a much harder time going full banana republic if the people actually carrying out the work under him were career government workers and not political stooges. So that's the good news. That's a small silver lining here. There are still adults in the room in the Biden White House, and they are Trump-proofing it in case Trump gets back in office. The bad news is there is a much more immediate threat coming from Trump right now, and it is highly unclear what anyone can do about it. Do you remember the guy who rammed his SUV into the FBI field office in Atlanta on Monday? Authorities haven't released an official motive yet, but in the past 24 hours, we may have gotten a clue. A few years back, an account believed to be the suspect's posted, "I love you, Donald Trump." If you feel like you're having deja vu, that is entirely reasonable. But this guy is actually different from the guy who attacked an FBI field office in Cincinnati 2 years ago. But that guy also apparently loved Donald Trump and was enraged that the FBI had searched Mar-a-Lago. And both of these attacks came after months of Trump demonizing the FBI and telling his followers things like the FBI and the Justice Department have become vicious monsters controlled by radical left scoundrels. Trump is not just going after federal law enforcement, though. He is going after the prosecutors and the judges who are trying to hold him accountable. NBC News can now report that police have filed felony charges against a man who has allegedly been sending threatening voicemails to New York Attorney General Letitia James and Judge Arthur Engoron. AG James is leading the civil prosecution against Trump in New York for financial fraud, and Judge Engoron oversaw that case. The man allegedly sent the messages like, "Mark my words, I will kill you if you even dare to permanently steal Trump's assets or his property. That kind of threat to a prosecutor and a judge overseeing a case involving a former president of the United States, that should be front page news. But it is not anymore. Because the idea that Trump's followers would threaten the people he labels as enemies has become totally normalized. This week, the judge in Trump's New York hush money case, Judge Juan Merchan, expanded a gag order against Trump because Trump was singling out and lying about Merchan's daughter. But somehow, despite literally being reprimanded in court just days ago for his threats, somehow Trump still had the gall to post this a few hours ago today. Trump called special counsel Jack Smith deranged and said that he should be sanctioned or censured for the way he is attacking Judge Aileen Cannon. What Trump is referencing here is the fact that Jack Smith disagreed with Judge Cannon in a legal filing. That is it. That is the sum total of what Donald Trump considers an attack when the attacker is someone other than Donald Trump. What makes that post so particularly unhinged is that the attacker here is very clearly Donald Trump. Trump demonizes people and then his followers threaten or attack them, and then Trump doesn't disavow any of it. The pattern is incredibly clear, and that pattern has poisoned our national politics. Trump has normalized the idea that an appropriate response to political disagreement is physical violence. Earlier this year, Reuters did the math and found that serious threats against federal judges, threats that are so serious they trigger an investigation by the U.S. Marshals, those threats have doubled since 2021. And serious threats against federal prosecutors more than doubled. The director of the U.S. Marshals said that in the past, judges mostly faced threats from people who were upset about a judge's decision in their own cases. Now, he said, many more are coming from people enraged because of politics. Joining me now is Andrew Weissman, former FBI general counsel and co-host of the Essential MSNBC podcast, Prosecuting Donald Trump. Andrew, thanks for being here. You know, to an ordinary citizen, this is disturbing. It should be disturbing. But to someone who's been inside the trenches of the Justice Department, of the FBI, who knows judges, who knows courtrooms, I can't imagine how this lands with you. And I just first, you know, as you see these judges become the object targets of Trump's ire and really targets for violence, what do you make of it? And how chilling is this to the judicial system on whole?
So to put it in context, when I started out as a prosecutor, I did organized crime work here in New York City. Something you did not have to worry about when you did organized crime work, because all these my friends would say, you know, were you ever worried? No. You know what a rule was in organized crime? You do not go after anyone in law enforcement. For sort of simple reasons. It wasn't because they're so moral. I mean, these people signed up to commit crimes. It was, what's the point of that? You're only going to attract more attention. And we were fungible. There would just be another person who would come in and prosecute, and you now have all of this heat attracted to you. So you just didn't think about it. I think your opening talking about how this is normalized, and that after it happens, if you want a really good sign of the intent of Donald Trump, it's the same way you look at January 6th and you say, you want to know what his intent was then? Well, think about what he did afterwards. He wasn't saying this is terrible.
Yeah.
If you see what happened and you see the FBI being attacked, you see judges being attacked, and you see people taking, you know, the call and response, if that was not the response you intended, you would be saying, absolutely don't do this. What I meant was to just First Amendment, I disagree with what Jack Smith is saying. I disagree with the judge's ruling. A lot of us have very strong views of the Supreme Court and its rulings. That is fine. What is not is obviously resorting to violence, and it's been completely normalized. I do think it's sort of, you know, the FBI has its hands full dealing with this and making sure. Just one thing I would note is the attacks on judges, it's bipartisan attacks. I mean, there are attacks against Republican and Democratic judges and not just words, but in deeds, and they're being prosecuted. But that's the kind of thing that has to be much more front page news, and it has to be sort of like the January 6th investigation. It needs to be something that people take seriously and call out politicians who don't say, you've got to stop this.
And I do want to talk about the attacks from the left. But in this particular case, we're talking about a candidate for president.
Absolutely.
Who is directly fomenting violence against everyone in the judicial branch.
Yep.
In his expanded gag order, again, against a former president of the United States who would like to be president again, Juan Marchand, and you noted this on the podcast, writes incredibly eloquently for history about this moment and the threats these judges are withstanding. He says, this pattern of attacking family members of presiding jurists and attorneys assigned to his cases, Trump's cases, serves no legitimate purpose. It merely injects fear in those assigned or called to participate in the proceedings that not only they, but their family members as well, are fair game for the defendant's vitriol. Why don't the judges, I mean, Judge Marchand expanded the gag order to include his family members, but why don't they say, I'm off limits too? I mean, they are the focus of Trump's ire.
Yep.
Is it just perceived, you know, sort of neutrality? It doesn't seem practical at this point.
Well, I agree with you, but if you're asking me where do I think it emanates from, I think it does emanate from this feeling that, you know what, I'm going to do my duty. I can deal with it when it's an attack on me personally, and I don't want to inject myself into the process. I need to maintain sort of being objective and fair and not taking sides. And the more I can do that, the better, especially when the risk is just me. But I think that judges are seeing, including in this clip that you just read, it is to allow it to go on with respect to anyone in the process, sends a message to everyone in the process that this is allowed.
Yeah.
So even though you say, don't do this to witnesses, don't do this to jurors.
Right. If you're withstanding it, you're suggesting that's a new norm.
Yeah, exactly.
The other piece of it that would seem to have profound effects on the actual judicial system is jury selection and witnesses. I mean, talk to me a little bit about that. I mean, already that's a process that is complicated in this day and age. And I wonder what your assessment is of like, okay, you're going to be sitting on the Trump trial or you're a witness with valuable information about Donald Trump's criminal acts. Are you really going to come forward?
So picking a jury in a high profile case, which I've done, nothing quite like this, has distortion effects on both sides. You have people who are, I do not want to be in the limelight. I do not want to suffer any opprobrium. I'm scared.
Yeah.
All of that comes to play so that you don't have sort of that segment of the populace serving. By the same token, you have some people who, you know, how most people don't want to serve on a jury.
Yeah.
Well, with a high profile matter where there's strong opinions, you have some people who are saying, I don't want to be on it, but you have other people where the biggest fear on both sides is that someone's going to lie, to sneak on and say they can be fair when they actually have firmly held views. And that is those two phenomenon, particularly the latter, is a real concern in a high profile matter.
Well, something like this. I mean, the other piece of it is, and you mentioned this a little bit when we first started talking, is when you were working in the FBI, there's no standard guiding procedure for what to do with, oh, are you a target of a former president who's going on trial? There's no expectation that you're going to become a target. And so I would assume there's no protocol, there's no guide, there are no guardrails in place for, you know, witnesses, for jurors, or for prosecutors. I mean, is the Justice Department even sort of manned in a way to offer protection or some sort of insurance to these people? It doesn't sound like it is at all.
Well, I'd say because it's such a new phenomenon. I mean, we understood, certainly in the Mueller team, we sort of saw that Donald Trump was going to attack prosecutors. He was going to attack the media. But it was as sure as these cases were brought, you knew that the judges and the judicial system was going to have its turn, because Donald Trump is going to vilify him. This is, he plays the umpire. You know, he sits there and says, you know what, if I win, it's fair. And if I lose, it's not fair.
Yeah.
So he's attacking all the judges except for Judge Cannon because he thinks she's favorable to him. And so I think that this is such a new phenomenon. I'm not sure the Justice Department has like a team that is devoted to, unfortunately,
Witness protection.
Well, witness protection, not just witness protection program, but the idea that you're going to really have a team that looks at attacks on witnesses, attacks on jurors, attacks on judges, attacks on prosecutors, and that is their main focus. It's not sort of parceled out. You actually have a group that's doing this. And unfortunately, really is time.
I do want to talk just, you know, quickly about the larger issue of justice, because as you point out, there are attacks from the left from people who believe, for example, the Supreme Court has done something appalling, abominable, un-American, and needs to be punished wrongly, physically, right, because of their opinion on Roe v. Wade, for example.
Right.
And that betrays a sort of uninvestment in the court or a cynicism about the court as acting from purely political motives. On the other hand, you have Trump saying the court and the justice system is acting purely politically. It's a witch hunt. The fact that you have actors on both sides now casting real aspersions on the justice system seems like a big problem for American society.
It is. And the problem is that you don't have enough people speaking out
in defense.
I mean, you know, I kept on remembering when Mr. Pelosi was attacked. I thought, oh, well, this is so abominable that of course, this is going to be widely condemned. So, you know, I'm naive. And it's the same phenomenon where you sit there and say, who could possibly be for this? And so it's such a sign of where we are as a country that people don't understand that you can have, you know, violent disagreements in terms of how you talk about something, and you can really, really care about an issue to your core. But that's where it ends. I mean, you voice those concerns. The idea that it's manifesting itself in violence without then society saying that's unacceptable.
Yeah.
That is where there's such, you know, I really do think Trump has just completely normalized what we're seeing in Washington, what we're seeing I'd say mostly on the right, but at times on the sort of far left and far right, which is making it normal and acceptable to engage in this kind of behavior.
And that's what he's doing in his post-presidency. The question is, if he returns to office, what then? Andrew Weissman, please do not leave yet. I have a lot more to ask you about, including this burning question. Can Donald Trump really declassify documents with his mind? Could that defense actually hold up in court? Today, it sort of seems like we got an answer. Also ahead tonight, I'll talk to voting rights activist and founder of Fair Fight, Stacey Abrams, about what Democrats need to do to get people to the polls. That is coming up right after the break.
If you're the president of the United States, you can declassify just by saying it's declassified, even by thinking about it.
In 2022, we all wondered how Trump's "I declassified it with my mind" defense would actually work in a trial. Well, today we got a glimpse of the answer, just a glimpse. Today, the judge overseeing his classified documents trial, Judge Aileen Cannon, rejected Trump's request to dismiss the charges against him. Now, Trump's lawyers had argued that the Presidential Records Act gave Trump the power to retain classified documents after leaving the White House, thereby protecting him from prosecution. You could declassify them just by thinking about them. But in a 3-page ruling, Judge Cannon said that the Presidential Records Act does not provide a pretrial basis to dismiss any of the charges. Now, while that may seem like Cannon is ruling in favor of Special Counsel Jack Smith, who has argued repeatedly that the Presidential Records Act has nothing to do with Trump's criminal prosecution here, Judge Cannon very much left the door open today for the former president to use the Presidential Records Act as part of his defense during the trial. And that means jurors or the judge herself could acquit Trump based on Trump's interpretation of that law. Back with me is Andrew Weissman. Andrew, how are you interpreting Aileen Cannon's move here? Like, why not just decide whether the Presidential Records Act is like a legit line of defense?
Which is exactly what Jack Smith said he wanted.
Yeah.
He said, just make a decision. We say that it doesn't apply at all. We want a pretrial ruling. In fact, the rules say they're entitled to a pretrial ruling. Just decide one way or the other for good, not the part of the clip.
Not halfway.
Not halfway, which is I'm deciding pretrial that it doesn't apply. Well,
but trial.
Jack Smith is like, well, who cares about that? I care about what you're going to say at trial.
Right.
Why? The big sort of thing that people need to understand to just be in the weeds for a moment. Once the jury is sworn, double jeopardy attaches. Meaning if the jury acquits or if the judge acquits, it's over.
It's finito.
So especially if the judge has the power, once the jury is sworn, to say, you know what, I'm entering a judgment of acquittal. And it can be on a cockamamie idea like the Presidential Records Act. So Jack Smith is saying, I need a decision that it doesn't apply, not just pretrial, because guess what? No one's deciding anything like about guilt or innocence pretrial. That's going to happen at the trial. So I need you to know what your view is at the trial. Why is she not doing it? Because, as Jack Smith said, with that ruling, I can, if I disagree with it, I have appellate rights. I can go up to the 11th Circuit. She is doing whatever she can, in my view, to prevent an appeal.
There is, without getting into all the excerpts from the, it's a short filing, but she uses some very strong language. She calls Jack Smith's position unjust. And she basically, like, Dirty Harry's it and is like, go ahead, make my day if you want to go to the 11th Circuit and appeal this.
Yeah.
What do you make of that posture in the context of all of this?
Well, you have to remember she has been reversed twice by the 11th Circuit in scathing language. She really hasn't acquitted herself well. Whether you think that it's from inexperience, whether you think it's because she's partisan, or both. Mm-hmm. My opinion is it's both. That she's both inexperienced and she is consistently ruling in unlawful ways for only one side. And when I say unlawful, that isn't just my opinion. That is the 11th Circuit. I think that she is not helping herself in this short opinion by using language that is not really becoming of an Article III judge. Mm-hmm. And I also think it can be fairly attacked as being inaccurate. Mm-hmm. And that inaccurate is a charitable way to describe it.
And does that hold water with the 11th Circuit? I mean, do you think if Jack Smith can get to the 11th Circuit through a writ of mandamus or an appeal without getting into the technicalities, do you think he finds a sympathetic audience there?
You know, so that's where it's going to very much depend on the panel. So the 11th Circuit is made up of a number of judges. A random group of three is chosen. So you don't really know who that is beforehand. So, you know, that I can't answer. But you always sort of say to yourself, if I'm dealing with judges who are rational and fair-minded, and you sort of have to take that as a basis, it's very hard to look at what she has done and say that's the correct legal answer. The PRA is a civil statute.
Yeah.
This is
came about after Watergate, was not intended for this use.
Absolutely. In fact, it was intended for the opposite.
Yes.
But here's the really key thing. It's a civil statute. This is a criminal case.
Yes.
Civil statutes don't apply.
It's not peanut butter and jelly.
With a criminal.
They don't mix together.
Yes, exactly.
Andrew, you know, we were talking about confidence in the judiciary, and I'm all for believing in institutional integrity, but man, Judge Cannon, she tests the bounds of that every day. Andrew Weissman, my friend, it's great to see you.
Thank you
for your
time.
Still to come this evening, we will talk to Obama's former White House Communications Director Dan Pfeiffer about what Biden is saying about Bibi and to Bibi and whether anything is about to change. Plus, a controversial call for Democrats to rethink their support for voter registration drives. We're going to get reaction from voting rights activist Stacey Abrams. That's next.
Here's the thing. All I need you to do is remind people about how important this election is coming up in November. And if you can ask people to go to vote.gov
to register to vote or to check their registration status, that would mean a lot.
Oh, that's easy. You know I got you.
That was Vice President Kamala Harris and Queen Latifah last month at the NAACP Image Awards, urging an audibly enthusiastic Black audience to make sure they are registered to vote this November. The Democratic Party has long been focused on voter registration as a core principle, and it has benefited from nonpartisan voter registration efforts in years past. But the Washington Post reports this week that there is a confidential strategy memo circulating among top Democratic donors warning that if they want Democrats to win in November, they need to rethink their approach to voter registration. The memo reportedly cites polling data showing that the share of unregistered citizens who would likely register as Democrats has declined, and the share of unregistered citizens who would likely register as Republicans has risen to the point where the two groups are almost even. It also reportedly cites polling showing that Trump is popular among unregistered voters. The Post reports that the memo's author told Democratic donors that if they were to blindly register non-voters and get them on the rolls, they would be distinctly aiding Trump's quest for a personal dictatorship. The author reportedly called on donors to focus their spending instead on specific, heavily pro-Biden populations like Black Americans. Joining me now is the perfect person to discuss this, voting rights activist, the great Stacey Abrams. She is also the author of, can you believe this, 15 books, including the political thriller Rogue Justice, which is out now in paperback. Stacey, it's great to see you. And wow, I mean, your prolific authorship, we are going to get to in a moment. But first, I just wonder what you make of this memo. I feel like there's a lot of conflict that Democrats may feel when learning about it.
I think it raises a very important point about the efficacy of voter registration, but I think it misses the larger picture, which is that we should have nonpartisan registration because that's how we protect democracy. Getting people to own their right to their citizenship, to their ability to cast a ballot and participate in elections should be a nonpartisan effort by everyone because we should want more Americans involved. The partisanship piece comes in where we want them to actually get the things they need. And my party, I believe, does a better job of delivering the outcomes that communities need. However, I think the misunderstanding that and the tension we're hearing is that we see this as an either or. But what I've done, the work that we did in Georgia, was actually never simply about voter registration. While that got the greatest share of the attention, we actually recognize that voter registration is like teaching someone how to drive, giving them the keys to a car. Mm-hmm. But then you have to teach them how to drive, and you've got to tell them where they're going. And those component pieces, registration is giving them the keys, but then you have to do voter education to make certain they understand who's in charge, what's happening. And then you actually engage them saying, here's where we want to go now that you have these pieces. And so while I do appreciate the tension that's embedded in this argument, nonpartisan or partisan, what we really should be focusing on is how do we engage non-voters who have to this date believed that their voices did not matter enough to put their names on the rolls. And that means we have got to stop these very reductive arguments and instead focus on the broader outcomes. And I will say that the success we had in Georgia is actually proves that this works. Because what we were able to do over the course of starting in 2014 with registration, continuing in 2018 and beyond with our engagement work, we actually built an electorate that shows what can happen. If you look at the post-2016 election cycle, in Georgia, you had about 525,000 African Americans, Black voters who were considered super voters. They voted in almost every election. Well, post the work that we've been able to do, that number is now closer to 870,000 people, a 65% increase. And that did not happen simply because more people got on the rolls. It happened because they got on the rolls, we kept them engaged, we made certain they understood who was responsible and what their power was. And what I would urge the Democratic Party to do is to lean in once again on the extraordinary success of the Biden-Harris administration, what we have done, but we cannot get distracted by whether or not we should engage more people in our democracy.
Yeah, I do wonder what you found, you know, in that first step where you're giving people the keys to the car, their level of interest in actually driving it, for lack of a better, building on your metaphor. In 2016, Pew did some research as to unregistered voters and sort of what motivated them to be unregistered or why they were unregistered. And 44% said they didn't want to vote. 27% said they hadn't gotten around to vote. 25% said no candidate or issue inspired me. And 6% said, I don't know how. Now, the I don't know how would seem to be like the easiest ones to get because it's a matter of like, okay, this is how you turn on the ignition. But the largest share here, the I don't want to vote and no candidate or issue inspired me, that, I mean, What is that conversation like? What do Democrats or anybody interested in a functioning representative democracy, like, what is the beginning of that lesson to get people to be engaged as you found it in your experience?
So we know that I don't want to vote often is an easy shorthand for I'm angry, I'm upset, I'm despairing, or the people who represent me don't actually hear me. I created two organizations in the wake of the 2018 election. Fair Fight, which is really focusing on protecting the infrastructure of democracy, making certain that once you get someone registered, governors and legislators can't have them thrown off the rolls or have them removed through mass challenges, which is unfortunately what Governor Kemp and his cronies are doing in Georgia right now. But it's also about making sure that they connect the dots. So often I don't want to vote means I don't actually know not how to vote, but I don't know who to vote for or why voting matters. Mm. And so I created a second organization called Fair Count that really focuses on connecting the dots, whether it's this, we use the census as our point of entry, but we give them pamphlets. We explain, this is the issue that you're concerned about in your community. Here's who's responsible. But if we don't do the hard work of connecting the dots, not simply in election years, but year round, we lose the opportunity to build that representative democracy. And that's why I'm so bullish on what has been accomplished by the Biden administration. We have stories to tell. We can explain why you should want to vote. But you have to begin by asking people, not just do you want to vote, but why don't you want to vote? What disturbs you? What holds you hostage? And what are you angry about? And also, what would make you joyous? What would make you excited about being a part of it? One of the ways you get to inspiration is by actually asking people what inspires them.
Yeah.
We keep hoping that it's going to be this manifest moment, but it's often just starting with, how can I help? What do you need? And how can we work together to get you there?
You've written 15 books, which is like, I mean, you have all this free time, I guess, between, you know, trying to save democracy, et cetera. What is the narrative? Like, from a storytelling perspective, there seems to be this binary choice of you either talk about democracy if you're Joe Biden or you talk about economic policy. And from a storyteller's perspective, what is the narrative this campaign should be focusing on if you're Joe Biden?
I think they're doing it. Today was the announcement of a record $27 billion being invested in climate action, specifically in helping low-income communities access the clean energy technology that so many others can take for granted. That's going to solve real problems. I'm part of a project in Georgia where we were able over Christmas to get someone a hot water heater, which sounds small, but if you've lived without running water, without hot water in your house for 2 months, and someone on the eve of Christmas says, I can help you, and I can make sure that your house is warm and safe and comfortable, and your bills aren't going to go up, they're going to want to know why, and they're going to tell their friends and their neighbors. And that's what Joe Biden has accomplished. We should be telling that story, but we should also be asking others, what else do you need? And when you answer the question, what else do you need? Ask them to decide who will actually deliver, who will deliver pontification and false promises, and who has actually proven that they will deliver the goods. And that's the question and the conversation we need to have between now and November.
Who's putting in the work and who's delivering the goods? Stacey Abrams, such a pleasure to hear from you, Stacey. Thanks for your time tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, President Biden says he ratcheted up the pressure in a call with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu today. And tonight there has been some movement on that front. We'll have more on that coming up right after the break. Inflection point. That is how one U.S. official described today's phone call between President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. According to a White House readout of the call, Biden pushed for, quote, an immediate ceasefire, and for the first time ever suggested that the U.S. may condition its aid to Israel unless Netanyahu implements a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address the protection of civilians in Gaza. The president also labeled Israel's recent killing of 7 aid workers from World Central Kitchen as unacceptable. And tonight, there appears to have been some movement. The White House says that Netanyahu has agreed to open new paths for humanitarian aid into Gaza, quote, at the president's request. Joining me now is Dan Pfeiffer, former White House Communications Director for President Obama and co-host of Pod Save America. Dan, thank you for being here. What do you make of the readout of this call and I guess what we'll call one of the results of it, which is the opening of this aid corridor?
I think the language inflection point is exactly right. This is represents a potential real change in how the president plans to use his leverage with Prime Minister Netanyahu to get Israel to change how it's handling civilian casualties in Gaza and aid for the people in Gaza. And the proof will be in the pudding. Will Israel actually follow through on this? And if they don't, will the president be willing to condition aid going forward or condition the use of weapons going forward? And so, but I think that tonight was a very important moment and he delivered results. And so that's a very good thing.
I guess I wonder, you know, we get these sort of leaks or reporting that Biden is infuriated with Netanyahu and that's unacceptable and he wants an immediate ceasefire, et cetera. And that's not unimportant and it is significant, of course, in terms of the broader posture. But then there's reporting that on the same day that seven world's central kitchen workers are killed, the White House approves the transfer of thousands of more bombs to Israel. Granted, that was approved by Congress earlier, but I mean, how much does that undercut Biden's position, his message, and how should they be handling those two clashing realities?
I think the shift in rhetoric today and the shift in actually saying, if you do not do a better job, then we are going to reassess how we're helping you, is the result of a very real and challenging political position for the president, where he was saying things, expressing oftentimes in background leaks from White House aides, his anger and frustration. And then Prime Minister Netanyahu is sticking his thumb repeatedly in the president of the United States' eye. And that made the president, I think, look ineffective in the eyes of the public. It was very frustrating to people within his own party who have a good faith disagreement with his policy approach here. And so what my real hope is that this represents a change in policy. Mm. And because this is ultimately not a messaging problem. It's not that the president wasn't saying the right things. Could he have said better things? Absolutely. But it was a policy problem. The decision that the president made that sticking close to Netanyahu would give him the best ability to influence how Israel conducted the war was not, I think, proceeding as they had hoped, and that Israel was not doing what the White House wanted them to do. And so there was a shift. And I think if what today's phone call represents an actual change in U.S. policy, a change in approach, that's a very positive thing substantively and politically for the president.
Well, yeah. And let's talk about the politics, because I agree with you that I think that this was driven by policy and probably Biden's own instincts about what to do on this. But he has borne a political cost for it among young people, voters of color. What, you know, as a political strategist, what has been the constituency that Biden has been concerned about, you know, up until the point of taking a more aggressive stance with Netanyahu? Is it independent swing voters? Is it moderate Republicans, Nikki Haley voters, who he wants to entreat to his side of the aisle? I mean, what do you see as a political calculation thus far, up until tonight?
I honestly don't think it was a political calculation, because it was bad politics domestically on every dimension. I think it was an actual legitimate decision the president made because he believed this was the best way to influence Israel's conduct. Because he is getting hammered from the right, he's getting hammered from the left. He was looking less effective than he would like in the eyes of the folks in the middle. And so I, as a domestic political person in a White House dealing with national security issues, this is a frustration I felt all the time. Is the policy decided on by the president, influenced by his non-political national security advisors, often put were based on what they believe was in the best interests of the United States globally, in global security and homeland security and all of those things, but were often really bad politics. So I really don't believe the president's position here was because he was appealing to these voters over these voters, picking voters on the right over the left. I think it's what he thought was the best, and there were political consequences to be paid. I think what I now think his conclusion is the policy is not working as he would want, so he's changing policy. The change in policy, I think, will be better politics, but it's a policy decision being made here.
As Biden grapples with this in a very substantive and head-on fashion, I just want to remind everybody that Donald Trump is out there saying, as it pertains to the conflict in Gaza, get it over with. That's the degree of detail he is offering the American public as he runs for office for a third time. Dan Pfeiffer, my friend, thank you for talking about this very complicated topic with me. Really appreciate it.
Always great to be with you, Alex.
Coming up, while he was president, Donald Trump oversaw the separation of thousands of children from their parents at the border. And tonight, he seems to be signaling a willingness to do it again, only worse, in a second term. That story is next. In 2018, the country was rocked by this audio tape, but I have to warn you, some viewers, some of you guys may still find it very disturbing.
No, this one too. Guatemala. No llores.
No, papá.
Papá.
Cuando saquen la comida. Ay, no, papá.
Cuando
saquen
la comida. Papá. Ya voy a llamar yo cuando sea. Ya le voy a meter a comer.
Papá, papá.
That was the sound of one of Trump's hallmark immigration policies, the sound of children being ripped away from their families at the U.S.-Mexico border. During the Trump administration, more than 5,000 families were separated that we know of. The Trump administration took zero steps to ensure those families could be reunited, and about 1,000 children remain separated from their families. The cruelty did not end there. During the Trump administration, immigrants were detained in appalling conditions. Children were kept in cages. Court filings described being migrant children being given rotten sandwiches and drinking water that smelled like chlorine. Outbreaks of disease went untreated. At one point, lawyers for the administration argued in open court that they shouldn't have to provide toothbrushes and soap to migrants in their custody. Treating human beings, treating children, like animals. That should be the great shame of the Trump administration. But instead, Trump has made it part of his platform for re-election.
The Democrats say, please don't call them animals. They're humans. I said, no, they're not humans. They're not humans. They're animals. I'll use the word animal because that's what they are.
That was Donald Trump at a campaign rally in Michigan this week. Trump has been teasing an even more radical vision for immigration in his second term, one that includes mass detention camps and deportation. While Trump has stopped short of saying whether he would resurrect his family separation policy, there are signs he plans to do just that. In recent interviews, Trump has tried to rebrand his federal kidnapping program as a success.
We did family separation. A lot of people didn't come. It stopped people from coming by the hundreds of thousands. Because when they hear family separation, they say, well, we better not go. And they didn't go.
Now tonight, NBC News reports that Trump is attending a gala sponsored by an anti-immigration advocacy group featuring several of the key architects of his family separation policies. So as Trump looks to make immigration the central issue of this next election, it's important to remember what America's immigration system really looked like under Donald Trump and how much is still left to repair. Things like the unsafe open-air camps near the southern border where migrants, including children, are left in the hot desert for days. Last night, a federal judge who consistently ruled against the Trump administration's treatment of migrants ordered Border Patrol to try to solve that problem by providing safe and sanitary housing for those migrants. One of the things Donald Trump might try to do in a second term is shut down that judge's ability to help those migrants. He tried it in his first term, and he is bound to try again. That is our show for tonight.